All right, just to remind you, I need to get back with Lenny Manna, who is the guy in charge of the Maranatha Church 35th anniversary celebration, which is going to be on July 12th. If anyone intends to attend that, the things they needed to know was, do you want to go to the zoo all day, and will you eat? I think those were the big issues they had to resolve. So, if you are interested, please. Well, you're going to—you don't have to go to the zoo all day, but you will have to go there at some point if you're going to attend. The buffet will be served at the Canopy Restaurant from 6:30, and they're just wanting to get a head count. So, if you're interested in attending, there would probably be places where you could stay. You would not have to put out any lodging or any of that. But please let me know, preferably by the end of day today. Okay, let's make sure you're in fellowship and continue on here. Dealing with the definition and description here, looking at authority, as Webster defines it, and we were stopped with point C, authority is distinguished from power in that authority is based on a legal or moral right, not simple strength or ability. So authority doesn't go, quote, to the strongest necessarily. It goes to the one on whom it is bestowed. D, from a biblical perspective, authority is simply defined as the power or right to make decisions or give orders. And E, the principle of authority is something that is inherent in God by virtue of the nature of his person and creative activity. Job 34, 13. God has authority over everything, and this extends, of course, to his creation. Since God, but if God exists, let's say there was no creation, God would still have all authority. It's not simply based on creation or his creative activity. It is based on the fact that God, by virtue of his person, has authority. We call his authority sovereignty. God rules all that is. He has always ruled all that is. If God was simply in this, as some people have suggested, for power, God already had all power. God's not doing this to gain power. God already had all the power and authority he needed, which, by as all attributes are, by definition, immutability means it can't change. So his power and authority hasn't changed ever and can't change. Job here, 34:13, who gave him authority over the earth? Who has laid on him the whole world? In other words, the responsibility for it, not laid on him, but the responsibility for the world. Who did all this? If he should determine to do so, he could gather together his spirit and his neshama, his breath, the spark of life. If God chose to do so, he could just pull everybody's spark of life and boom, the whole human race would fall over dead just like that. And that's all. And for the God, it would be no more difficult than lifting his little finger. And he could do all this. And all flesh would perish together, and man would return to dust. And so God, again, by nature of his person, has this authority, and by virtue of creation, since he created it, it's all his to do with as he sees fit. Now, negative volition does not like this. Negative volition doesn't like the fact that God can do what he sees fit, that God is right. But negative volition doesn't factor in that God doesn't just do what he sees fit. He does what's in accord with righteousness. That he does what's in accord with what is right. And unfortunately, again, for us, as we saw, as we've said in this book, in eternity past, God's moving from point A here to point B. His big plan is constantly moving on. It's being fulfilled. But down here, we see the messy part of it, where it looks like it's out of control and God's not in control and what's he doing and who knows what he's doing and why did this happen and why does that happen and all these types of things. This person maladjusts, that person maladjusts. It's a big zoo down here at some level. But yeah, inexorably, slowly, step by step, point by point, day by day, we are advancing towards God's culmination of all of this. Ultimately, in eternity future, I recognize, the millennium is a significant part of that thousand-year rule. But even again, at the end of all of that, what do we see? Negative volition is still negative volition. You cannot make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. It's an impossibility. And you can't turn negative positive. And ultimately, you can't make positive people negative unless they choose to go so. You can't effectively cause people to cash in their phase two unless they choose to. Now, you can obviously fail and all that, but ultimately, the Bema seat, only one person is going to answer for each person, and that is that person. They're not going to be quizzed on what so-and-so do to you. How come you couldn't make it? Did they not apply to it? Did you need somebody to hold your hand and help you along? Well, other believers that do make it at the Bema seat, of course, are going to be rebuked all that. So, F, in that regard, every person has been delegated authority from God under the principle of volition, divine institution number one. You have volition. You have the inherent freedom to act. That doesn't mean you're going to use it right. That doesn't mean that your actions will be commensurate with God's will, even. But God recognized this, had to have recognized this, as an occupational hazard of being God. Long before he created Satan, long before he created mankind, God had to know people were not going to use their volition in all regards to glorify him or to submit themselves to his plan. And yet God created volition anyway. Why? Because creating volition was apparently the right thing to do. And God did the right thing. Now, if people abuse volition, that's not God's fault. People, you know, they want to blame God for it, but it's not his fault. And the principle is no less valid simply because people mess it up, or angels have messed it up. The fact is, when God created Satan, he knew what was going to happen. He knew about the fall. He knew about the five falls of Satan. He knew about Satan's manifesto there long before Satan ever uttered those words. As a matter of fact, he said, "You have said in your heart." He knew them before Satan even articulated them. So all people, are also responsible for their decisions and actions and will be held accountable by God, who will judge all men, Psalm 96, 13. So this is another principle that we try to stress, that people tend to want to focus on authority. Oh, the authority has the power. Yeah, but they also have the responsibility that goes with that power. And every good authority knows that. Psalm 96:13, before the Lord, for he is coming. All the trees of the forest will sing before the Lord, for he is coming. He is coming to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in faithfulness. We saw this alluded to in Ecclesiastes, where Solomon clearly acknowledges that God's going to judge the world. He didn't make any comments off of it, other than just simply in passing, "I know this." 3:17, "I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man." And Solomon, in some regards, as he works through these things in life, his grand experiment, shall we call it, Solomon's no different than you and I are. Some days we bring the doctrine we know to bear on the matter. Some days we don't. At this point, he did. "I said to myself," and this is completely 100% divine viewpoint, "God's going to judge both the righteous and the wicked." That was based on the doctrine Solomon knew. Now, did that always influence his view of things? No, not necessarily. Because he bemoans the fact that the wicked seem to get away with their wickedness, and the righteous seem to be punished sometimes for their righteousness. Well, nevertheless, that doesn't render, again, the principle invalid. Ecclesiastes 11:9. Here to his much younger audience, he gives some very great advice and tells his audience, "You know, I know things about life you just don't know." But he does it in a real nice way, I think. I don't think he would have offended his audience the way he went about this. "Rejoice, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of young manhood, and follow the impulses of your heart." Why? Because your virility is pretty short-lived. Again, once you hit 35, you're on the downhill side of this thing. And again, the peak of youth and the bloom of youth and all of that and the peak of young manhood goes by pretty quickly. And people who don't spend their time doing the right things, well, he counsels them. Go out and recognize you're going to desire to do certain things. Go do them. But also recognize this. If you do them without integrity, if you do them outside of God's will, if you pursue things that are unrighteous, that God's going to judge you for this as well. That you're not, you don't have carte blanche here from God, just go do what you want. God doesn't give that to anybody. Yet know that God will bring you to judgment for all these things. You better keep this before you in the background of your little frame of reference here while you're out bungee jumping. Or whatever it is young men want to do nowadays. You know, whatever the new thrill is. It's all, you know, it's always a thrill. This is what young men pursue. That's why they live so dangerously in many cases and die so young, many of them. I'm not a big fan. You may be, and if you are, I'm sorry if I offended you. But let's drive a car 180 miles an hour around an oval track with a bunch of other cars and see what could go wrong there. Let's make the body out of fiberglass. Well, you can do that if you want. You know, I don't have that desire anymore. I don't think Solomon had the desire to go out and drive fast at his age. But, you know, no doubt as a youngster, he probably did. We got to say, if anyone ever sowed their wild oats, it's got to be Solomon, right? No one could ever accuse him of holding back. Oh, there was things I wanted to do, I didn't do. Solomon didn't get to the end of his life with any regrets in that regard. Boy, I wish I would have. Nope, I did it. Whatever it was, I did it. I did everything I wanted. I withheld nothing from my eyes that I saw. Revelation 20:12. Now, having studied this book, and we're not done with it yet, of course, do you think that served him all the time to do that? The answer is no. Didn't serve him all the time any more than it would serve you all the time to run under your sin nature. Or even to just explore, what do I think I want to do? Revelation 20:12, and I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and the books were opened, and another book, which is the book of life. Consistently here through here, by the way, I don't know how people can muddy this up having studied the book. I can see how it got muddied up before, but there's only one book of life. There are books, and then there is a book of life, only one. And in this book of life, all names of all people from the foundation of the world who were positive were written down. And that is the book of life. That is God's record, as it were, in eternity past, that I know who's going to be here at the end of this thing. And I can prove it. I've got it written down well before you were even born. So there is but one book of life. There isn't, and God's not blotting people out of that book. That's a gross misunderstanding of the premise that's taught there in the first part of Revelation. I will not blot your name out of the book. Number one, he doesn't threaten to blot anybody's name out. He just said, I won't do it. Why? Well, he can't do it by virtue of the fact that this record is perfect. Or else it's not a valid record at all if it's not perfect. So the book of life, but they're judged by their deeds. That's the books. That's the books of their deeds. And each one, and they were judged from the things that were written in the books according to their deeds. And that's consistently what we see throughout the scripture. The believers at the Bema seat, every believer is going to be recompensed according to his deeds. You see it here with unbelievers at the great white throne. They're all recompensed according to their deeds. So you have freedom and authority to act. You have the right, the power. But you better exercise that power pretty wisely. Because ultimately you're going to be judged on how you handled it. One divine institution, number one, is the first level of authority established by God. Again, we have these concentric circles of authority. It starts with individual authority. You have individual authority, but do you have the right as an individual to intrude in another's realm of authority? No, you don't. Absolutely not. That would be, the next second wave of authority out there. No, you don't. And when you do intrude into another's realm of authority, this is the consequence or the issue that we know as trespass. That's what it means. That's what a trespass is. You've intruded into a realm where you don't have the right to be. It's not your call. So this is critical, obviously, to the resolution of the angelic conflict. That God knew that Satan would fall, of course, and in fact, a third of the angels would with him, and that man would ultimately fall. But yet the free choices of men prove that everything God said in the beginning, apparently, was right. We were not privy to the trial of Satan. We have, in fact, bare bones minimum information on this. But what we do know is this. We can fill in the gaps in some ways with just simple logic. We know that sentence has already been passed. That means the judge has already ruled. And yet we know the sentence has not been executed. The lake of fire created for the devil and his angels. That's not the place down in the center of the earth where people are staying right now. Unbelievers who died and gone there. And whatever segment of the angels was involved there in Tartarus with the Genesis 6 infiltration. They're there. And people are dropping into there daily. Bing, bing, bing. Ching, choo, choo. That's what, you know, I like those counters. Several people send me those counters. I like to see what's going on in hell right now. I get the counter for hell and the counter for heaven, and I'll bet they're going way slower in heaven than they are in hell. I'll bet the count goes up in hell quite a bit quicker. Since we know broad is the way that leads to destruction. So you have the lake of fire. We know the sentence has been passed. The judge has ruled. And yet, Satan is still free. We can only conclude that he must be out on appeal. We don't know what the trial was like. We know that God had to preside as judge. No one else was qualified. And yet, no doubt, Satan impugned the qualifications of the judge, his right to judge even. This had to be some of his arguments. You don't have the right to judge me. And God is insisting, yes, I have the right to judge you. Just as I have the right to judge everybody. That right is inherent in God by virtue of creation. I created you. I can judge you if I choose to. And that's God's right. See, and when you start talking about God's rights, well, then people, well, wait a minute. Yeah, well, God has rights too, just like everybody wants to appeal to my rights. Well, God has rights. So the judge has ruled. Sentence has been passed, but not executed. Therefore, logically, Satan is appealing the sentence at some level. And God has allowed the appeal. And he has granted a space for this appeal, apparently. And that's what we know as the 7,000 years of human history. That is the length of the appeal. This is how long you can appeal. And at the end of 7,000 years, I will have proved that your appeal is going to be denied. You will take your place in the lake of fire. Well, first, that's at the end of the 7,000 years. First, at the end of 6,000 years, let's assume Satan can read the Bible. He's pretty smart. I think he can. At the end of 6,000 years, I'm going to have an angel come down and lock you up. An angel, by the way, it would appear to me, and even before that, in Daniel's 70th week, just prior to the midpoint, I'm going to let Michael eject you from heaven. Your access is withdrawn. And in both these cases, the unspecified angel there in Genesis 20, or 20, yeah, or pardon me, Revelation 20, not Genesis. Both Michael and this unspecified angel, by definition, were weaker than Satan. They had to be less in power and authority. Because Satan was the number two. He was the main cherub that covered. And he was number two in the plan of God. So all angels, by definition, are inferior to him. At whatever level. Whether it's power, authority, or whatever. Intelligence. They are inferior to him. And in both cases, these inferior creatures now come and grab Satan by the scruff of the neck, let's say, and unceremoniously humiliate him. And so at the end of 6,000 years, I'm going to let an angel cast you down here, and he's going to cast him down into the center of the earth, into the abyss. And I'm going to set a great seal over him, as it were, and his right, his authority to act is removed. Now, your volition means nothing. You're in prison. And guess what in prison? They don't consult the prisoners. You guys want to watch TV today? How, you want to go out and exercise? In a real prison situation, you don't consult the prisoner. The prisoner loses all rights. The only thing he hasn't lost, and which he never can lose, of course, is his right to life. He'll live forever. So Satan's there. Now pretend you're Satan for a moment. This will be easier for some of you than others. But pretend you're Satan. And you're down there, and you've got 1,000 years to stew about this. And you're alone. You've got nobody to talk to. You're absolutely confined. You're powerless. As we might say, God's going to put him in a straitjacket. How do you feel? Not happy, probably. I would say not happy would be the bare minimum of his emotions. I'm sure he's going to be enraged. I'm sure he's going to think of all kinds of things. What's going to run through Satan's mind during that period? Who knows? But Satan now has lost his right to act. And this is what we call the overruling will of God. That God will remove your right to act at some point if you act up too much. Now, God's obviously very patient, kind, graces us out. I mean, look at how many times really you could probably be, if you honestly judge, you could say, God should have smacked me down, and he didn't. He graced me out. And but God's very good at this, obviously, because one, it's his nature. And two, look, he's put up with Satan. By comparison, we pale. As bad as we may be from time to time, we're not Satan. So Satan loses all this. His appeal is finally done in. And then, of course, at the end of the 7,000th year, he gets out for a little bit. We don't know how long it says. A little time. And I view it in terms of months. I don't think it's a long time. He immediately instigates the human race, gets them going again. See, the human race is such a collection, in some cases, of losers that they're just like rabble ready to be roused. And all they need is somebody to stir the pot. Well, for 1,000 years, there's nobody to stir the pot there. And so volition kind of cranks along, albeit maybe not willingly. Because we do know that during the millennium, there's going to be volitions that choose not to obey God. That's why we have Operation Rod of Iron. You may choose not to obey God, but I've got the iron rod. And the iron rod can hurt. If you get hit with an iron, you've ever been hit with an iron rod, you have an idea. And that's used as, again, a figure to denote absolute, complete righteousness in government. Criminal activity will not be tolerated. But yet, even the people might be overtly law-abiding during the millennium, don't you think? Some of them. Many of them, probably. Why? Because out of fear of what's going to happen if they're not. And but are they righteous? See, law-abiding and righteous don't always mean the same thing. You can coerce obedience to law simply by creating an environment where the person is fearful of disobedience. But can you create righteousness? No. And what we see in the human race is, while many of them may be overtly compliant through the millennium, at the end of it, it doesn't take long to get that rabble stirred again. And then once the rabble is roused, there they go. They come and surround the broad city of Jerusalem and on the broad plain there and decide to attack it. Well, God summarily puts this down. And then throws Satan into the lake of fire, where, because of the abuse of his volition, he will find, again, people have these weird ideas that are created by the cosmos. Satan's ruling down in hell. I see it on South Park. I know it must be true. That's where I get my doctrine. I don't get my doctrine from movies or TVs. I use my doctrine to judge that stuff. But I see it, and people have thought this for years. Satan rules in hell. No, he doesn't. He will be the most debased creature for all eternity that ever has existed. Even those people that he snowed, those humans, those flesh maggots is all they're going to be at that point. We don't know what kind of flesh it will be, but there's a pretty gruesome picture painted there in Isaiah chapter 13 about this, and chapter 14. When people see you, you're going to be despised. You're going to be the most debased creature in the world forever. And maggots will be your covering. And I guess if you got an infection, maggots are all right, but generally speaking, people don't like them. And worms will be your bed. And people are going to come by and hiss and snarl and sneer at you and ridicule you for all eternity. This is Satan's great fall. But why? Because he abused the principle of volition. So, too, every person possesses volition, which is the basis for our individual authority. Further, each person has the responsibility to respect the authority of every other person, just as God does. Three, all delegated authorities must recognize the importance of this divine institution. Since the sovereign God created and honors volition, up to and including Satan's volition. He is still allowing Satan to function under his volition to this very day. Why? Ultimately, it's advancing his plan. We may not see how or why, but it does. So, four, society, churches, marriages, and other human relationships would be a lot more civil if people would just simply respect the authorities of others to act. But again, this is an issue of everybody's got the right to do what they want to. In a sense, we could all get our T-shirts, print Total Freedom on them, wear them all the time. But we have to recognize that within that freedom, every freedom brings privileges and responsibilities, just as volition does. What are my responsibilities? Is it just simply to act with no regard for anything else? No, clearly not. H, delegated authority, is the legal right entrusted by God, whereby members of the human race have jurisdiction over and responsibility for other members of the human race. This authority often comes by virtue of their office or position. God, throughout the Old Testament, appointed prophets. He established them. He validated their words. Not everybody was a prophet. Not everybody could be or would even aspire to be. But one thing that was understood is the prophet was an authoritative voice of God. And when he spoke, you better listen. Even if you didn't like what he was saying, and very often, because the nation was often in spiritual dire straits, they didn't like what the prophets were saying. The prophets very often rubbed the STA of Israel quite wrong. Instead, any study of Jeremiah and Isaiah and some of these other prophets, and you recognize they were not popular people. But by virtue of their office, they were a prophet. They were in the office of prophet. They had the legal obligation and authority to act before God and to do what they saw fit. And that went on again. We see that God's always had spiritual authority. God did establish a king over Israel, not because it was his will. God desired this, as he always did, to be a theocracy, a nation under God, which, of course, we claim, but we're not. But that's what he really desired for Israel. And America never was the replacement for Israel, have some have taught, if you hear any of that nonsense. Israel's a priest nation, we're the client nation. No. God never appointed anybody to replace Israel except the church. That's the only one. And it's a nation among nations. It's not even an individual nation. It's his people scattered throughout the nations. So God established all this. Okay, the prophets had the right to act. King had the right to act. Moral right, legal right from God. Had the apostles had the right to act. And Jesus gave them authority and sent them out and said, do thus and such. Cast out demons and all this. But he also gave negative commands. Don't accrue silver for your belts. Don't try to get rich off of this deal. This is not why you're here. And he gives pastors authority to act. And then the deacons have authority to act. And everybody in their own sphere and in their own realm. But the office provides a certain amount of authority. And that's where it comes from, simply by virtue of the office. Pastors are no different than any other people. They put their pants on one leg at a time, I assume. That's how I put mine on. You know, I don't think at any level, humanly speaking, that any pastor is superior at any level to anybody else. But by virtue of his office, he is. That office is. That's what makes the deal. And so God puts people in these positions. Well, they're expected to fulfill that office and do what they're supposed to be doing. Well, since God is the ultimate authority, all levels of authority, rank, and the entire chain of command proceed from him. One, since God is the only one with absolute authority, all human relationships contain three levels of authority. Two, this would include God and the legitimate authorities over the person, the authority of the person, and the authority of those under the authority of the person, assuming you have someone under your authority at any level. Again, it could be any place in life. If you're a parent, you have authority over a child. If you're a husband, you have authority over a wife. If you're a place on a job or you're a boss and you have people that have to answer to you, then you have authority. And so you have the authority of God, you have the authority of people above you, you have your own authority, and then you have the authority of people below you. And that's why it's quite critical for people to figure out where they fit into this deal. And most people have way too much view of their own authority. People are very impressed with their abilities. Well, you got to know your place in the plan. That's what you see about the great believers of history. You look at Daniel. Daniel knew his place in the plan. And his niche changed radically over the course of years. But he always knew his place in the plan. He was always oriented to that. When he was functioning there in the nation before it went into captivity, no doubt Daniel was doing the right things. I would suggest to you, Daniel was already praying three times a day before they went into captivity. That was probably Daniel's M.O., the way he functioned. And then when he went into captivity, he saw it as God's will to be most likely emasculated and put in the book of the eunuchs there for Nebuchadnezzar and serve in the royal court. Now I can hear some believe a doctrine, well, that would be wrong. How could he serve that pagan king? Well, God changed his niche. But God changed it. He didn't. God changed it. And Daniel oriented to it. And he accepted when they changed his name. Daniel, you had Mishael, Hananiah, and Azariah, who became Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And Daniel's name was changed. Did Daniel rebel against that? Did he say, no, you can't change my name. I'm Daniel. No, he oriented to it. And so he recognized that Nebuchadnezzar had all authority. And plus, if he didn't know that, see, I would suggest to you Daniel was oriented to this principle before Nebuchadnezzar's dream, which allowed him to interpret that dream for Nebuchadnezzar. You are the head of gold. You have all authority. All sovereignty has been given to you by God. And from a sheer authority standpoint, power, and all of that, Nebuchadnezzar was the greatest king that ever lived in terms of just sheer authority and might. He consulted no one. You lived, you died at his word, at his whim even. And that was it. So if people would recognize their authority, their right to act, your right to act isn't necessarily guaranteed. If God took Daniel into captivity, he wasn't going to do anything. Now, Daniel also recognized he could make this this request of his captor there. Hey, we don't want to eat this food. It was a violation of the dietary code. And on top of that, it probably wasn't healthy. But I would suggest Daniel probably did it on religious grounds. And God honored that. He said, okay, we don't want to eat this food. You test me out and we'll eat this other food. And if we come back and there's any problem, I'll take responsibility for it and we'll eat your food. But he didn't have to. So Daniel acted, knew what to act, when to act, how to act. Daniel also was he's a very good study of what we're going to get here in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, and that is how to act within the halls of power. Daniel was a master at that. His life would be worth studying if that for no other reason. So he functioned under Nebuchadnezzar. He functioned under the Medo-Persians, two different rulers there. And actually another king under the Babylonians, Belshazzar, got into power there, but not for very long. And so Daniel did fine with all these authorities that he had to deal with. And they were changing. They weren't even always the same. And God blessed him in all that he did. Why? I would suggest to you it's because of his orientation. To not only this principle, but to many principles, of course. Well, three, those that fail to recognize this principle often do not respect the authority of others. Those that reject authority may well reap the reward of having their authority rejected. That is just simply a observation off of the principle of sowing and reaping. And the principle of sowing and reaping is taught in a number of places in the Scripture, but it's such a fundamental, basic principle. It's taught in terms of giving. Here it's taught in another context. But it's such a fundamental principle of human experience that we all know it's true. You reap what you can't hope to reap anything other than what you sow. And the sowing are our actions on a daily basis. And the reaping are the things that come to us because of those actions. Sometimes, just as a mere fallout from our actions, you do something stupid, and then there's immediate fallout from it, and that may not be even divine discipline. That can just be self-induced misery. Just the consequences of your action. Or, alternately, God can actively intervene and judge you for your actions. So, again, Galatians 6:7 here, do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Not effectively. Now, people mock God all the time. But what Paul means here is you're not going to effectively get away with this. It doesn't work this way in the physical realm any more than you could go out and plant a crop of peach trees and hope to grow apples. Nobody in their right mind thinks that's going to happen. So Jay here, delegated authority exists at every level of the human race, both in the physical realm and in the spiritual realm. K, there are two distinct realms of authority which we will not fully develop here, but we will make the distinction. Moral authority and judicial legal authority. Moral authority means you stand for it because it's right. It's the right thing. It's what's only fair and moral and ethical. And that authority exists. And then you have judicial and legal authority, which may or may not be moral. Again, it just depends on the nature of the authority. Now, it should be, in an ideal world, our judicial and legal authorities should function under the same realm of morality that the Bible sets forth. But we know that's not the case. Solomon knew that was not the case. This is not new news under the sun. There is nothing new under the sun. That which has been done already. And that which will be done is that which has already been done. And nobody's going to undo it or change it. History is destined to just continue repeating itself. Why? Because men don't change. Men are what they are. And the STA doesn't change. It is what it is. And so you have moral authority, and you have judicial or legal authority. Ideally, they would be the same. That a judge, say, would have a correct moral compass and judge according to sound moral principles, rather than according to expediency, respecting a person's and all these other factors that people, because he's taken a bribe, judges can rule a lot of ways. So LS, an office confers power. That's legal authority. Doesn't matter what the office is, whether it's pastor, teacher, whether it's president, whether it's governor, city commissioner, I guess. I don't know. I don't know how they're elected. I don't care at a certain point. That power can be abused if it is exercised beyond the parameters of that office. Therefore, those that have been charged with authority will give an account for how they used it. John 19:11. And so, some people get impressed. Well, first they get impressed with their own authority. Just because you have volition and you have authority, don't get too impressed with that. Because everybody has that. Except your dog or cat, they don't. But every human being has it. So in that regard, you're no better or no worse than anybody else. You have authority to act. Doesn't mean you're going to do the right thing. John 19:11. Oops, that's 20. I don't know what Mary standing outside the tomb weeping has to do with authority, but Jesus answered. Now here's Pilate in his arrogance and his human viewpoint and his stupidity. I have authority over you. Sure you do. But guess what? I'm not impressed with your authority over me. Why? Because Jesus answered to a higher authority. Do you not know that I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you? Jesus answered, you would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. So I look to a greater authority than you. While right now, from the physical standpoint, Pilate was the greatest of the earthly authorities with whom Jesus ever dealt. But Jesus said, I see a bigger authority behind the scenes here that I answer to. For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin. And did Pilate use his authority properly? No, absolutely not. This was a travesty of justice, and he knew it. His wife knew it. Anybody watching it knew it. Everybody could see what was happening if they wanted to. No, he abused his office badly here. But does that mean Pilate should, be demoted or whatever? Well, that's up to God. And that's another whole thing here. While authorities have to answer for what they do, those under authority have to just put their authorities in God's hands at a certain level. It would be nice to think, well, I'll just go to my authority. I'll reason with them. I'll give them sound judgment. And they'll just figure it out and go with it. Yeah, step away from the pipe. It doesn't always work that way. In many cases, it doesn't work that way. You would think so. What could Jesus have said here to extricate himself from this position? The answer is nothing. The die was cast. He knew it. And he doesn't seek to wiggle out of this or to try to usurp Pilate's authority or get around it. He acknowledges you've got authority, but you only have it because God gave it to you, and that's the only reason you have it. And they may have the greater sin. Do you think Pilate's going to be judged for this travesty of justice that he committed on the Son of God? I think so. I think that'll be one of his deeds he'll answer for. And I wouldn't want to be in his shoes. But he had the sin. They may have had the greater sin, but he had the sin too. And they were engaged in active conspiracy against Jesus, where Pilate was just a little pawn, a little dupe in their plan. He was just one of the little things they needed to work. And so they forced the situation, of course. Also, Hebrews 13:17. in the spiritual realm. That's the establishment chain of command there with Jesus and Pilate. Obey your leaders. You have the word here, pytho, again, to be persuaded first. To be, you know, compliant with, and then ultimately, of course, to obey is the bottom line. Be persuaded by your leaders. And submit to them. For they keep watch over your souls as those who will give an account. And the reality is, let's face it, you wouldn't need spiritual leaders if you could take care of your own soul at a certain level. You just wouldn't need them. Doesn't make any sense to have them if a believer can just take care of himself at all times. But you have, as we're using the pastoral analogy, you have the wolves. The wolves are out there. On top of that, the more dangerous is the wolves in sheep's clothing, because they look like sheep. And sheep, unfortunately, in the analogy, anybody that knows anything, sheep are notoriously stupid creatures. They're not much smarter than turkeys. The reality is none of the animals out there in the animal realm are that much smart, as it were. But the wolves in sheep's clothing, the false doctrine, all those things, it's impossible for a believer to just go out and filter all through that and make sense of it all. It's one of the oppressive jobs of the ministry, is to have to deal with some of that stuff. But as a part of an apologetic approach at some times, which you have to answer, you have to give your apologia, your defense of the faith. This is the faith, and here's why we do it this way. And here's why this doctrine's wrong and this doctrine's right. You may have to make judgment calls. You got to keep, and that's a problem with sheep too. Another problem with sheep, using the pastoral analogy, is they tend to wander around too much. Sheep are oblivious at some point to the danger to which they've exposed themselves, or to which they face. And then when the sheep's a casualty, well, it's too late. Can't do anything about it. Then the sheep's dead. And so we have warned again repeatedly, while we respect your volition, your freedom to act, and all of that, that our job is to look out for you, to watch out for you, to protect you from yourself sometimes. Because sometimes you're making bad decisions. And we try to address it again. I never have tended to address it much one-on-one. We try to keep it just strictly from the pulpit, keep it somewhat impersonal. And if it applies to you, you take the doctrine and apply it. If it doesn't apply to you, sit there and enjoy the Bible class. They're going to give an account for how they used it. That's Hebrews 13:17. Let them do this with joy. They're going to give an account. And every good pastor never lets that get away from him. He always keeps that before him. I'm going to have to answer for all this. You know, how I did it. My study techniques. My study ethic. My work ethic. As one of the things, we are having some discussion there, and I was there visiting one night, me and Jack and another guy were sitting around talking, and we got into discussions of, you know, other local churches and what's going to be our policy toward. Well, one, we're never going to, quote, have a policy among churches because each church is independent and autonomous, so you really can't formulate that. But as we got to kicking the situation around and the subject, it became increasingly clear to me that we ought to have certain things that seem to me to make sense. For instance, if another local church contacts us, says we need help, okay, are we just going to throw money at them? Are we going to do any investigation? I would think we would. If you're going to be asking believers to contribute to something as the leadership, you have a responsibility to know the facts before you even ask them to participate. So I would think, you know, of course, and we've done this with Living Grace too. We don't just throw money at people, come and say, I need Living Grace. You don't just get it. We have, you know, things you have to do. You have to fill out a form. You have to reveal your finances and why you're in financial trouble, why you need help. And hopefully it's, you know, if it's a one-shot deal, that's fine. You get your one-shot help and you move on. But this also provides the leadership an opportunity to help a believer that might be struggling. Maybe doesn't have their financial act together. And when they come for Living Grace, then it becomes a possible learning opportunity for them. See, Living Grace isn't just there to be there. It can be a teaching aid. Well, if other people come from the outside and they say, we want help. You know, one of my first questions is going to be, has that church done everything they can do to meet this need? And by everything, I mean everything. I mean, if a church, let's say a church calls up and says, hey, we want some help, but the pastor's not working, but they can't make ends meet. Well, I think I know my answer to this one. Get a job. Read the book of Job and then get one. You need to get a job. If the support isn't there, what have we taught all these years? We've taught if the support isn't there, the pastor should make whatever sacrifices are necessary in order to maintain his integrity and keep the ministry going. As long as it's positive volition there and God's the Holy Spirit's in it and all that. My position, I think, is going to be, and I'm willing to discuss this, I'm not fixed in granite yet, but I'm pretty well sure what Paul said there to all believers, if you don't work, you don't eat, would also apply corporately to churches. If you have problems you can't meet, get a job. This isn't hard doctrine for me to understand. And so I've always been of the opinion that full maintenance is a privilege. It's not a right. Paul didn't demand this absolute right for all pastors. He didn't even demand it for himself. And so the point is, I got some idea about authority and how to use it. But one of the things with authority is you got responsibilities. And you especially have responsibilities to those in your own congregation as to what you do. In an ideal world, all pastors would be on full maintenance and everything would be great. Nobody would have any needs. Well, guess what? It's not an ideal world. Never will be. So here, well, we've only got a couple of minutes left, so I'm not going to dive into four. We will just pick up fresh there on Wednesday and close with this idea that authority brings responsibility, and the ultimate authority, God, will judge all lesser authorities for the manner in which they use their authority. And if the authority was not used in a manner commensurate with God, and this goes down to all people, I mean, this gets down to every action of every free moral agent, then God will finally pass judgment on that and say that wasn't right. And then the believer either wins or loses, as we know at the Bema Seat. Okay, well, we'll stop there and continue on here Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying these things. May God, the Holy Spirit, enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.